When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. This is Daniel Paris, host of the New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted to have as my guest today author Richard Vaig, an author and investor, currently the managing partner of Gabriel Investments in Philadelphia. His new book, A Brief History of Doom, 200 Years of Financial Crisis, just came out, and it's a very interesting read. Richard, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So you are in an interesting spot, and one I'm very sympathetic to, both a practitioner investor and clearly someone with a historical bent. And you have brought into clearer light a focus on debt and the role that it has played in prior crises. And obviously, there's an implication in regard to the current situation. But do you want to kind of provide a background as to why you consider the key factor in looking at various crises through the past 200 years of debt?
Yes. We all know that runaway mortgage lending led to the 08 crisis. And I had been a student of the Great Depression and, a couple other crises like Japan's crisis for years. And once it became so clear that private debt was the culprit in 08, I wondered whether if we look back at the Great Depression, we would find the same thing. So with considerable effort, I pulled together banking information on the 1920s. And sure enough, there's this runaway lending period from 1923 to 1928. You know, it's heavily real estate oriented. It just underscored what we learned about 08. So I also wondered whether Japan's crisis, which really became manifest in 1990 and 91, was also debt-based. So I pulled that information together and did the same analysis. And sure enough, it's rampant lending in that period. So we have just, in this book, extended that investigation. We've looked at the top six countries in the world over the last 200 years, which collectively account for 50% of world GDP. And we've examined, to varying degrees of depth, 43 different crises. You know, we look very hard at six or seven of those and a little less deeply at the rest. But every single one is a result of very rapid run-up in debt with compromised credit standards. In other words, bad loans being made in high quantities in the 3 to 5 years before the crisis.
And, you know, it's funny, history repeats, it doesn't repeat itself, but it, you know, kind of rhymes. Are there various themes, jokes about that? But one of the things that you come away with, or I come away with from reading the book, is the financial memory of market participants and lenders in particular is awfully short, because it does appear to be, if not exactly the same, very, very similar mistakes are made over and over again. In the spirit, almost, again, you point out there are major crises and minor crises, and you spend more time on the major ones. But if you look at the minor ones as well, it's roughly every 10 years, plus or minus, when there's at least a bubble somewhere in the economy that bursts. It's really striking how little we've learned. Is that one interpretation?
Clearly, there hasn't been as much investigation of this subject as it warrants. And, you know, frankly, you know, we'll go into a lot of these crises, and most of the research and work is done on at the moment of crises and in the years afterwards. And for a lot of these crises, very little work, if any, is done in the 5 years leading up to the crisis. And to us, that's the most important thing to study. And, you know, sure enough, we see these rampant increases in lending. You know, it's railroads in the 1800s. It's, you know, housing and commercial real estate in the 1920s. It's commercial real estate in Japan in the late 1980s. You know, we see that again and again and again. And once you start fixating on this period, one of the things you notice is that in the early phase of a lending boom, things really get wonderful. You know, you're making more housing loans and you see that housing prices go up. And you don't think it's because we're doing a lot more lending that the pricing is going up. You just think you're a really smart lender and lots more people get jobs, prices, you know, housing asset prices go up. Everybody's getting rich. Everybody's paying more taxes. The government debt picture starts to improve. It's a wonderful time. And I think that's one of the key things that makes it so easy for folks to feel like this time is different, to use the well-worn phrase.
Is it correct, though? And I'm just pointing it out that a lot of the lending that you refer to, Is it debt, just real estate debt? Because in various forms, one or another, is it private sector lending? Is it real estate debt? Is it unsecured? Is it borrowing on margin? You clearly lean in the direction of real estate lending. That seems to be most of the crisis. Is that because, frankly, that's the pool where there's the greatest slack and opportunity to lend money? Or is it something about real estate lending that in each of these crises tends to... And again, it suggests that the railroads were in the 19th century almost a derivative of real estate lending. But is it real estate lending or just debt per se that seems to get out of control?
Well, you need to look at the composition of private debt. Right now in the United States, as an example, we have about $30, $31 trillion worth of private sector debt. We have about $20, $21 trillion worth of government debt. So private debt, to begin with, is the much bigger factor. But if you look within private debt, real estate lending is almost half of it.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mortgage lending is about, you know, $10 trillion. Commercial real estate is about $4 trillion. So, you know, if you have a problem in real estate, it's going to be a big problem. Energy sector lending is only about $1 trillion. So in 2016, we actually had a major energy lending problem, you know, and I don't know what the exact number was, but, you know, let's just say 10% of those loans went bad. Well, it's only $1 trillion. That's only $100 billion problem in a sector that has $2 trillion in capital. If you have a 10% problem in real estate, that's $1.4 trillion of bad debt in an industry that only has $2 trillion in capital. So it's just the relative size of the sector.
Yeah, and I suppose if you know, what matters at the time. So in the 1920s, the leading edge of the kind of the spear was the stock market, the S&L crisis in the 80s, and that's real estate, Japan's real estate and general lending. I'm just looking through your kind of table of contents and your the railroads, obviously, in the 19th century. So it's wherever the economy is leading. But if you have roughly, as you point out, half of the overall private debt in real estate, it's going to lean in the direction of real estate, roughly speaking, at least half the time, as it were. But each of the crises that we've had has had a slightly different lean. You know, the derivative crisis and the mortgage crisis specific to the S&L crisis from two decades earlier, you know, they're both real estate related, but different mechanisms, different transmission mechanisms.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they each have their own flavor to them, you know, and then in the 1830s, 1830s, a lot of it is canal debt, because the big, you know, the big business of that day is canals, and it's the real estate development in and around canals. You know, by the time you get to the 1850s,
railroads,
the 1857 crisis, it's railroads, and you know, and so forth. So they each have a little bit of a different flavor to them, but by and large, real estate plays a huge role in every single one of them that we've observed.
So now. I don't think anyone would dispute that. One of the issues that, at least in my day job as an investor, comes up, and kind of structurally and academically, is looking at single factor explanations. And it's very helpful for clarity to look at single factor explanations. But, you know, no one gets tenured at the University of Chicago by looking at single factor explanations. You know, the more complexity that you can layer into it, and the more obfuscation, the greater your academic success. This leans in the direction of a single factor explanation in a world that is oriented towards multi-factor explanations. That, as you were writing this and thinking this through, you know, did you stub your toe against the Fed? Did you stub your toe against regulatory issues? Did you stub your toe against individual personalities, the Cooks of this world, or J.P. Morgans of this world, Vanderbilts of this world, who may have had as much of a factor or an influence on the development of a crisis as the actual debt? You know, and how did you get comfortable with a single factor explanation?
Well, we hoped all along, you know, we've been working on this pretty hard since about 2011, and we have always hoped, and we still hope, that there are additional factors that you can bring into bear, because, you know, we want as much predictive power as possible. And we failed, and we've looked really hard at kind of, you know, we have a database of 47 countries that is reasonably comprehensive, going back at least to 1960 and generally to World War II. For some countries, we've got data all the way back to the early 1800s, and we can look at each of these things, and we've always hoped. But something like government debt, for example, which a lot of folks attribute these crises to, is almost a contrafactor. You know, government debt in Spain, leading up to their 08-09 crisis, actually improves as a percent of GDP by 13%. So that's a dead end. So we go through these things very rigorously with a lot of data, and we don't find it. You know, there's one factor that actually helps mitigate the accumulation of private debt, and that's when a country has a large net export, positive net export position. I'm not talking about 1 or 2% to GDP. I'm talking about 10% to GDP. And, you know, that can really create an earnings stream that helps pay down.
Is that the description of China currently?
You know, that
high debt, but high exports?
That's one of the things that's a mitigating factor. You know, we don't think it's, you know, we don't think it's going to save the day in China. It's certainly going to soften the blow. And by the way, their net export position is significantly diminished from where it was in the period of, say, 2003 to 2007. So, you know, where it reached almost 10% to GDP. But it is the other thing that we note. You know, there's other things that come into play, because I would argue that, you know, economics is a behavioral science and not a physical science. So there's not any mathematical formula that carries the day, because the way the government behaves once the trouble begins to manifest itself has great bearing on how things play out. Clearly in the 1930s, the government's a hard ass. And, you know, let the banks fail. Let's purge the rottenness out of this. Well, you can see what that brought. You know, the United States in 2007, early 2008, has kind of a let institutions fail mindset. And that's one of the things that brings Lehman to its knees. And we saw what that brought. China has the opposite point of view. In 99, they have, you know, a terrible problem in their banks. They have been, you know, profligate lending to spare. And yet they, because they own and control everything, very deftly use what amounts to accounting fiction to let the banks get through their problems. So, you know, there are other issues to understand and to contemplate here. So it's not entirely a one factor issue, but the one factor is the biggest.
China is an example. Japan's another example where culture is an enormous factor. For the Japanese to acknowledge a bank failure was, as you describe in your book, is a huge deal and took a long time. And again, different countries, I suppose, will bring a different sentiment to that, so that everyone experiences kind of a debt crisis individually. One is it culture? I wonder if the culture of the United States that leads to the cyclicality here and the repetition of this is growth. That is this culture of growth. I happen to work in the public equity markets, and there's no tolerance for a steady cash stream. It needs to be a growing cash stream. Companies need to grow, and they need to grow faster than GDP. They need to grow faster than their peers. If they don't, they'll be bought out with borrowed money themselves. And this relentless focus on growth in the finance sector is going to lead to cyclical lending above and beyond what every other pressure would be to lend to cyclical lending. That is, have you encountered country-specific explanations as to why the cycle of excess lending occurs in each country, or is it just happens?
You know, I think you've hit the nail on the head, which is to say, this is a function of human nature. You know, this is the way to win. If you're a football coach, is to win the Super Bowl. You know, the way to win if you're the CEO of a computer company is to sell more computers or sell more phones or what have you. The way to win if you're a banker is to make more loans. That's what gets you a better stock price, a bigger bonus, a promotion. And therefore, it is absolutely intrinsic and endemic to the system, and it crosses borders. I wouldn't try to argue that it's a lot greater here versus there. It's the way you accumulate power and wealth. So it's there, and you know it just turns out that if it happens in the banking business, you create too much capacity. Too much real estate lending means you have way too many empty office buildings, or way too many unsold homes, or way too many railroads in the 1800s for the number of passengers that you actually have. And once you have significant overcapacity, it means the economy has to slow down. You can't build a lot more until years pass by and demand catches up with supply. And it also means a bunch of banks have a bunch of bad loans and fail or have to be rescued. So, you know, that part of the story is a constant.
There have been busts that are outside. If you think about the internet bubble, it doesn't really fit in your story, which is not that that's a problem, but it is a bust that is independent. If I think of major contractions in the U.S. economy over the past century, they all more or less fit within your pattern. The internet bubble doesn't, other than, you know, overgrowth or overexpansion of operations within a narrow sector of the economy and everyone getting crazed, but it really isn't a broad-based economic lending cycle exercise, is it?
So this is where you get into the definition of what a financial crisis is. And to me, a financial crisis is a very simple thing. It's when a lot of banks and other lending institutions fail or come, you know, have to be rescued. And so what we studied was that type of crisis. There are also occasionally stock market crises that happen where bubbles burst, but the lending community is not hurt. And it, you know, so the internet crisis deserves its own study. You know, you didn't have millions of consumers hurt as a result of that. You had stock speculators hurt. And by the way, even that one, if you study it, there's a very tight correlation between margin debt and the stock market boom.
Sure. Which is a form of lending. Sure. Yeah. Well, let's go back and at least cover a couple of these, and then, you know, kind of mention you do not really choose to have a chronological order. The organization is it goes from crisis to crisis, but it's not organized chronologically. And that the point of that is to...
Well, the juiciest crisis of all is the Great Depression. So that's chapter one. And it's the one about which, you know, the most has been written and there's the most disagreement. And in my opinion, there's the most misunderstanding. So I just, it was simply irresistible to me to start there. And that once we got there, we were semi-chronological. You know, we went from there to the 1980s crisis, which is the next big crisis and really the third largest crisis of in America in the last century.
And that is the SNL and various banking, true bank and lending and real estate across the country, Texas in particular.
Yeah.
And leverage buyouts and so forth.
Junk bonds. It was the 80s were a mess. It's just that the chickens came home to roost in the George Bush administration rather than the Ronald Reagan administration, even though all the problems really emanated from behavior during the Reagan administration. That's the second one we tackle. It's also the one where I came of age as a banker. So it's a sentimental favorite. You know, then we go to Japan, which really happens more or less at the tail end of America's 80s problem. And, you know, it's the other huge crisis. So we deal with really the three biggest crises prior to our own common experience in the 08 crisis. Then we take a pause and we go back to the 19th century, really asking the question, is this a new phenomenon or does it have precedent in prior periods? And we conclude that it's just endemic to the industrial age.
And you cover as you say, the emergence of kind of modern banking and specifically the 19th century as a combination of railroad crises, also agricultural crises, commodity prices are far more significant in the economy and for real estate lending at that time than they are now. And it's also incredibly periodic that in the 19th century, pretty much every 10 years, plus or minus, you have this cycle. There is no regulator there. It's a much more wild and woolly period that lends itself to that type of cyclical analysis.
I mean, you know, we start... You know, 200 years ago at the Second Bank of the United States, which is just down the street from where I live. So it's also another one that I've grown very fond of. And, you know, they opened for business in early 1817. And almost immediately have made so many bad loans, reckless loans, you know, all across the country. I believe the Second Bank ends up with as many as 25 branches. So, you know, you're overlending in the new cities like Cincinnati and down in the South in Baltimore and Charleston and other places. And it gets, you know, loans go from at a point where no other bank has more than like $1 million in lending. The Second Bank gets up to like $60 million in lending. So you can see how much it dwarfs the other banks in the landscape. But you know, it goes from $10 million in loans to $50 million loans in 1 year. So clearly, you know, it's almost as if they don't know how to lend. There's also a lot of fraud in that, and it brings the crisis of 1819, which is one of the reasons Andrew Jackson comes to hate them so much.
Now, usually Andrew Jackson gets a bad rap for not renewing their charter. You seem to... do you have a strong opinion in regard to that? Or I think he didn't renew it for many reasons. This may have been one of them. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. So what's really going on, and, you know, Jackson has little to do with this, but in 1831, you have about 2 million acres worth of federal land sales. By the time you get to 1836, you have 20 million, 10 times as much land sales. This is essentially all debt financed, and any number of Western and Southern cities see their land prices go from, you know, $10 an acre or $50 an acre to $1,000 an acre or $5,000 an acre. Folks feel like they're getting rich, but it's all built on this shaky foundation of debt. And so you have a lot of land sold and a lot of real estate structures built in the mid 1830s. that won't get sold, won't get used for decades. I mean, it's just extreme overbuilding. Somebody has, you know, to me, it brings up the interesting question, which is once a boom is well underway, how do you manage it so that you have a soft landing? You've already pointed out that there's cultures like Japan that kind of pretended like it wasn't happening and kind of let the banks deal with it over 10 or 15 years. Well, Andrew Jackson didn't deal with that way. He basically said there's massive overspeculation. We're not going to let people buy federal land with debt anymore. That was the species system of 1836-37. And sure enough, it all comes crashing down.
Well, so he fixed the problem quickly, but he's kind of gotten a bad rap in the financial media. Maybe it's because the financial media itself likes this or is part of this culture. Let's move to the current period, which is as you point out, a lot of people are asking, well, how can you tell if you're in a crisis or not? If you're in the midst of it, you know, are we in one now? I want to, before we get to the kind of juicy current stuff and your view in the future, I want to ask one question that for me is very important, which is that presentist bias that we all have, where we can't see a crisis, particularly if we're in the middle of it. I circle back to the main point that interest rates in this country, you don't spend a lot of time on them, but they seem to me a huge driver of the current attitude towards debt, that interest rates in this country had been coming down for 35 years. And that interest rates coming down for that long a period of time, the two generations of market participants, creates a culture of debt that is a one-way culture of debt, which is more is always better. And the last 2 years, interest rates, we'll see whether they've bottomed or not, but they stopped going down dramatically about 2 years ago, and two, 3 years ago, and have been moving sideways ever since. But to me, it seems, and I have been only in the industry for the last 20 years, so you correct me.
Only 20 years.
Yeah. So the attitude towards debt has changed, and that at least right now, people are very concerned about being over. The publicly traded banks have very lean loan books. The non-bank institutions do not, but the bank institutions have very lean loan books. The corporations I track have feasted at the table of debt for decades, but for the last 2 years, they're trying to step back as much as they can and slim down. And there seems to be a change. The question is whether is that change towards debt? Is it too little, too late? And where do you see us currently in terms of your cycle of borrowing, overborrowing, and contraction?
So I think there's a relatively straightforward way to examine whether there's too much debt in a country or in a sector. And that's simply by dividing that debt into GDP and looking at that trend over 5 or 10 years. We frankly look at it back as many decades as we can. But if you look at aggregate U.S. private debt to GDP since 08-09, it's been relatively flat. And I personally don't think there's reason for a lot of alarm within the United States right now. Now, I quickly add that there's certain sectors within that there is a reason for concern. So if you did that analysis just on highly leveraged transactions, which I believe are about $1.5 trillion, so again, it's a small piece of a $30 trillion pile, but highly leveraged transactions to me are an area of great concern, but it's a small sector. Student lending has been coming up as a percent of GDP. It's an area of concern. I actually think agricultural lending, doing that same analysis, which we've just done in the last few days, agricultural lending is once again reapproaching the levels of 1982 when the ag industry got into so much trouble. So we think we're going to have little areas of problems, but it's not going to rise to the level of a national systemic problem. If we look at Asia, the story is very different. You do that same analysis in China or Australia or South Korea, any number of other countries, there's very valid reasons to be very concerned.
That is debt, private sector debt as a percentage of GDP is at alarming levels based on past history. It's curious, how do you do the data in Australia when they have that 3 decades of no recession?
Well, I think it's very important to understand whether a country is kind of a hegemon in its area or whether it's a satellite of some hegemon. And, you know, China is what makes China's GDP is, I mean, China, as long as China keeps, China's economy is, you know, 10 or 12 trillion, depending on who you listen to. Australia is about a trillion. So Australia's trends are really going to be a function of what happens in China. And that's true for most of the economies in that region. That's, frankly, that's true of South Korea and Malaysia and Indonesia and Vietnam and, you know, any other. So, you know, if China itself has an even more material slowdown or reversal, I think all of those folks are going to feel it in a very significant way. And frankly, you're seeing it a little bit in Australia right now. They've had a decline in real estate prices. You're seeing it in South Korea, where they've had the first dip in GDP in quite some time. So I'm not sure that, you know, I would frankly think that over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to see that reversal in Asia.
But that being said, given your method, and despite the title of your book, A Brief History of Doom, you don't see us at least in the U.S., at an extreme point currently.
We are not. We have small pockets of issues, but generally speaking, we're not facing a situation like we did in 07.
And then how does this end up being reflected in, you are kind of a venture and early stage business supporter. Are you looking at debt in the, and I believe that your investments tend to focus in the Delaware Valley area, is that correct?
Yeah, we're early stage investors and our companies, you know, could get debt, it would get debt if they could, but they're too small and they can't. So it's kind of a non-issue.
Okay, so your companies, as you say, are so small that these macroeconomic issues are less relevant than their own particular business.
That's right.
So this is not directly related to your day job, related but not directly. So this is simply a tracking the rise and fall in the cyclicality of debt and economic activity. It's just an intellectual interest of yours.
This has been a labor of love for me and for our group.
Okay, well that's.
One of the things we've done that we're very excited about is that we have gone out and reconstructed data, especially private lending data, in each of these crises for a period 10 years prior to the crisis itself and for 10 years after. And we have, in many cases, had to go to dusty corners of libraries and get railroad manuals from the 1800s, etc. You know, we've gone to our dusty archives for some of the German data for 1870 and so forth and so on. And we've put all this out on Excel spreadsheets at our website. And one of the things we're excited about is academic researchers in this area are starting to use the data we put out there to kind of sharpen and improve the research that's being done in this area.
Please mention the website. Feel free.
It's very complicated. bankingcrisis.org.
Any other thing that you would like to kind of summarize or make sure the soon-to-be readers of A Brief History of Doom, 200 Years of Financial Crises, and anything you want to make sure those future readers know before we wrap up?
Well, we hope we've written it in a short and lively way, so we think it's something folks are going to enjoy.
As far as doom goes, making doom enjoyable and debt, you have to acknowledge that the people who find debt crises and the history of debt crises enjoyable are a select group of the population, present company included, but it is a select group of the population.
It's a select group of the population, and we love them all.
My guest has been Richard Vague, the author of the just published from the University of Pennsylvania Press, A Brief History of Doom, 200 Years of Financial Crisis. highly recommend taking a look at it, whether you enjoy debt or doom or not. It simply is, if you are watching the economy or the markets or economic development, is something that you need to absolutely be aware of. And it is, for a data-filled book, it's actually very easy to read. The points are well made and clear. Richard, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for your interest.